number I gave, the career of Rodrigo Borgia, I believe that was our last subject. And is it E or F? I forget. Anyway, the next one will be Savonarola. Savonarola. S-A-V-O-N-A-R-O-L-A. This will be the next capital letter under heading 12, which was the 15th century. L, Savonarola. Thank you. L is Savonarola. The Italian Renaissance, which we looked at to some extent last time, was a great forward movement in art and in aesthetics, but largely pagan in spirit. Now we have something that is quite in contrast to that, but that interrelated with it. This was a man who some say is the greatest preacher in the whole period of the Middle Ages. His name was Girolamo Savonarola. I don't think you need to try to remember his first name. I have to look it up myself when I want to pay attention to it. But his last name, as I told you, was S-A-V-O-N-A-R-O-L-A. He was born in Ferrara, a town in northern Italy, at which we have noted several important events, so I haven't stressed it particularly. It's not one of the most important towns in our history. Much more important than it in the life of Savonarola is the place where he had most of his life activity. That is the city of Florence. He did not come to Florence until he was nearly 30 years of age. He was born in Ferrara in 1452, and he entered on the study of medicine, as his grandfather had been, a physician. But at the age of 23, he secretly left his father's house and went to Bologna, where he joined the Dominicans. And he wrote a letter to his father explaining the reason for his abrupt departure. He said, "I could not endure any longer the wickedness of the blinded peoples of Italy. Virtue I saw despised everywhere, and vices exalted and held in honor. With great warmth of heart, I made daily a short prayer to God that he might release me from this veil of tears. Make known to me the way, I cried, the way in which I should walk, for I lift up my soul unto thee. And God in his infinite mercy showed me the way, unworthy as I am of such distinguishing grace." Savonarola then was tremendously stirred at the age of 23 at the widespread vice and sin that he found all around him. And so he joined the Dominican order, and there he began studying Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, and then turned his attention to the scriptures, and soon was devoting most of his attention to the scriptures. He committed great sections of the Bible to memory. In Florence, there still are two copies of the Bible with copious notes in his handwriting, on the margin and between the lines and on added leaves. And in the latter part of his life, he spent a great deal of his time studying and expounding the Bible in the original Hebrew and in the Greek. He was a very close and devoted student of the Bible, and one who was tremendously stirred by the sin of the nation at the time and by the prophecies of the Bible, particularly of the minor prophets, that God would come and would purge the world, would do away with the wickedness and the sin, and he was preaching the urgency of the message that people should turn away from their sin, should turn to Christ, and should prepare for the wonderful things that he felt God was going to bring soon. He declared, "God is going to reform his church, and some of these living here will live to see it." This was the great burden of his message. It was a number of years before he was particularly, before people paid a great deal of attention to him. He faithfully worked at his study, preaching as he had opportunity, and winning a certain number of followers. He went to Florence, was there a brief time, and then was away in another city. And there, one of the humanists, one of those who was in the circle of Lorenzo the Magnificent, who was the ruler of Florence, this man heard him preach and was tremendously impressed by it. This man was Pico della Mirandola, whom I mentioned to you last week. Pico della Mirandola was one of the most brilliant of the humanists. He was a He was a great student of Oriental languages, studied Arabic and Syriac and Hebrew, these other languages. He was tremendously interested in these languages. And then he was greatly impressed in this other town when he heard Savonarola preach. And he put in a word in Florence to try to get Savonarola back to Florence, where he had been for a brief time before. And so in 1489, Savonarola was invited back to Florence. And the remaining 9 years of his life, he had a tremendous impact on the city of Florence. Now, the invitation for him to come back had come because of the orders given by Lorenzo the Magnificent, who was the ruler of Florence. He was the head of the Medici family, one of the most wealthy men in the world, a great patron of art and literature, a man who was a man of great ability in many ways, a rather worldly man in the main. We mentioned already how his brother had been killed in the church service, and he had barely escaped with his life when Pope Sixtus IV had tried to get them out of the way a few years before this. Now, Lorenzo did not have any particular interest in Savonarola's message. He had liked Pico della Mirandola, and Pico was enthused about this preacher and thought it'd be nice to have him back in Florence, and so Lorenzo gave the word that he should be invited back. And Savonarola came to a monastery in Florence. It is now a museum there. It's called the Convent of St. Mark. And this convent had beautiful pictures on the walls all through it, painted some years before by Fra Angelico, one of the prettiest painters. I'd say one makes the prettiest paintings, not outstanding like Michelangelo and Raphael, but very lovely paintings. And these had been made some years before in all the various rooms of this convent of St. Mark's. And it's probably on account of those that it today is a museum. But in this convent, Savonarola was a monk, and then he became the prior of the convent. Lorenzo de' Medici tried to make friends of him. He came to the convent and sat out in the courtyard, and people came up and he said, "Savonarola, Lorenzo's out there in the courtyard." Well, he said, "Let him sit there." And they said, "Well, you ought to go out and greet him." Well, he said, "If he wants to see me, he can ask for it." And he wasn't going to toady to him in any way. And that was the attitude that he took toward Lorenzo. But in his sermons, he did not preach much directly against Lorenzo, but he preached against the wickedness of Florence very, very strongly. And the people began to be overcome with emotion as they heard him preaching. Sometimes he had as many as 10 or 12,000 people listening to his discourses. And he felt about Florence as Calvin later felt about Geneva and John Knox about Edinburgh. He was so anxious to stir the people to turn away from their sin and to make it a righteous city. And he preached a great deal on the minor prophets, saying how God was going to bring terrible calamities for the sins of the people. God was going to reform his church. He didn't hesitate to point out the wickedness of the popes and of the leaders of the church of the time and to denounce very strongly their wickedness. In 1492, Lorenzo was on his deathbed, and Lorenzo sent word that he would like to have Savonarola come and be at his deathbed. He wanted to have absolution before he died. And so Savonarola came. And Savonarola said, "Well, there are three things you'll have to do if I'm to give you absolution." He said, "What are they?" And the first one was, you must look to the grace of Christ alone for your salvation. You must determine that you will turn away from anything that is contrary to his will. And Lorenzo said, "Yes, I'll do that." And then he said, "You must give back whatever you have taken fraudulently, any gains that you have that were wrongly taken, you must pay back." And Lorenzo said, "Yes, I'll give orders for that." Then he said, "You must restore to the people of Florence their freedom." And Lorenzo says, "Oh, I can't do that." And he said, "Well, I can't give you absolution." and he turned over and died without. But the story was widely told, and it wasn't long after that that the Medici were driven out of Florence, and Florence became a republic. And the people, the leaders of the republic, began to look to Savonarola for leadership. And he preached great series of sermons which so moved the people that one day there was a great procession of young folks going through the city, going to everyone and urging them to listen to Savonarola's message, urging them to follow as he was preaching, urging them to give them their lewd pictures and their rotten books and all the implements of vice they could get a hold of. And they made a great stack in the central square, a tremendous pile of these things, and they burned them there. And the city just seemed to be entirely following with Savonarola. And in fact, there was such a tremendous pitch of emotional excitement that you wonder just how long it could last. But his influence was very, very great, and he predicted great overturnings in the near future, and shortly after that, the French king came with a great army and marched into Italy, and many thought that this was a fulfillment of Savonarola's prophecy. Savonarola was able to, many of the statements he made were fulfilled, in often in what seemed remarkable ways, and he began to think that he was like the prophets of old, that God was giving him special vision as to what was going to happen in the future. Now, we're not in a position to judge whether God did give him any such visions or whether the general predictions of the Bible found a certain number of exemplifications in some of the events of the time. But it did greatly increase his influence there. However, Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia, called Book of Savonarola silly declaration of being a prophet. And he particularly was incensed because Savonarola rebuked the wickedness of the papal court, in which, as we have seen, the degradation was so great that it was as bad as the papacy back in the 11th century, or in the 10th century, had been. And in fact, it was much worse because of it being, instead of it being as then just a petty chieftain with other petty chieftains in Rome against him, it was a man with tremendous power and influence throughout Europe who was having those wicked revels in the Vatican, having his illegitimate children raised to great honors, and doing things that are so bad that even McSorley in his book says it is impossible to rehabilitate Alexander VI. But Alexander called upon Savonarola to show respect to him. And before he did that, first he offered to make him a cardinal. If he would be quiet and obedient, and he would make him a cardinal and give him great honor. But Savonarola denounced these offers and declared he must follow the scripture, he must stand for the truth, and then the Pope gave very strict orders that he must be silenced, he must not preach anymore, and that he must desist from his attack upon the papacy, and he threatened to put Florence under an interdict. And Pharaoh tells about it in his Pageant of the Pope, and Pharaoh has no respect for a man of the type of Savonarola. He speaks very slightingly of him constantly, and he represents it as if here was Alexander, whom Savonarola was not respecting his authority. What could Alexander do but have Savonarola put out of the way? So Alexander had found it difficult to do because of the great support for him in Florence. It would take time to look at the details, but eventually it came about that there was a change of feeling in Florence. There was a great ordeal called for to prove who was right by walking through fire, and then it didn't work out, and there was a revulsion of feeling against Savonarola. And one night, some people rushed into the monastery and seized him and took him off as a prisoner. And then he was submitted, put to terrible torture in order to confess that his prophecies had been fraudulent. And he was put through this terrible torture, and in the midst of it he would cry out in agony, and they would take the words that he cried out and claim that he had confessed, that he had pretended to, wrongly to be prophesying the future, and that he was a fake and so on. And then they released him from the torture, and they sentenced him with two of his principal supporters to be strangled and then burned. And so there, they were brought out from that great palace there in Florence, out to that great central square in Florence, and there their ropes were taken off, the three of them. They were demoted from their position in the church, and they were strangled, and then they were publicly burned. And then, for fear that people would venerate the ashes, the ashes were taken and thrown into the river, in order there could be nothing people could keep for souvenirs. But for years after, there were always flowers put on that spot on that day every year thereafter. And a subsequent pope gave an order that there should be put in Savonarola's room in the monastery. There should be put there an inscription which would say that everyone who would come to this room and say a prayer in memory of Savonarola should receive a certain amount of indulgence and release from purgatory. And that remained in the room until during the Second World War, during the confusion of the Second World War, it some way disappeared. And it wasn't there the last time that I was there, but it had been there previous to that time. There have been those in the Roman Church who have tried to make out that Savonarola was a saint. There are others who have tried to calumniate his memory. He was not a doctrinal student. He was interested in the practical situation, in calling people away from sin, calling them to righteousness, declaring that God was going to intervene, that Christ was coming back to put an end to all the wickedness, and they do not find specific statements, as in the case of Wycliffe and Hus, where he specifically took the superstitions and denied them. But they do find a great emphasis, which is very different from the general emphasis of the Roman Church. Martin Luther thought very highly of Savonarola, felt that he had been a true minister of God. He certainly was one who was utterly devoted to what he believed to be right. And Pharaoh, in his book, after he tells how Savonarola was burned, then, because he didn't obey Pope Alexander, there's nothing the Pope could do but have him burned, then he begins his next paragraph with the word, Alexander continued his vicious way. And that's the way Pharaoh goes on to tell about Pope Alexander Borgia and about the wickedness of his life in the Vatican. It's very interesting that this man, Pico della Mirandola, who was attracted by Savonarola's preaching and had something to do with his being brought to Florence, after he came, was still more affected by his preaching, and became tremendously interested in the scripture and tremendously interested in the messages that Savonarola had. And after Savonarola's death, there was a young Englishman named John Colet, C-O-L-E-T, who came to Florence for study and became acquainted with Pico. And Pico had a tremendous influence on John Colet. You might say it was thus the indirect influence of Savonarola, because Savonarola influenced Pico, and Pico influenced Colet. Well, Colet went back to England and became Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And he had considerable influence, though he died before the Reformation got really underway, as Pico Mirandola also died quite young. But Colet became a good friend of a man from Holland who visited England, who was the greatest humanist of the time, and named Erasmus. And Erasmus became a very close friend of John Colet. And Erasmus was interested in Latin and in Greek and in ancient literature, a great humanist, but not greatly interested in the Bible. And Colette talked to Erasmus, and Colette's enthusiasm for the scripture, which he had received from Mirandola and which he had received from Savonarola, came in time to exert considerable influence on Erasmus. And Erasmus issued the first printed Greek New Testament. And he wrote, he spent a great deal of study on the New Testament book and on the early fathers. And some people went so far as to say Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. And to how great an extent that is true, of course, there certainly is a very definite element of truth in it. And Savonarola was a very important link in the chain that produced it. Now, I don't say that this produced the Reformation. The Reformation would have come just the same without it. But the Reformation probably was twice as strong and twice as apt to really get going without being stifled at birth as previous movements had been, on account of what Erasmus did, which was mediated to him directly from Savonarola. And so God works in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. And a man who stood for righteousness and exalted the scripture and did what he felt was right and seemed to die an ignominious death, and Florence, which had for a time seemed about to become the model city of righteousness, lapsed back into being a typical Renaissance city, though it's perhaps as great a center of art as the world has ever seen. But as far as Christianity is concerned, it was certainly not as bad as most of the great Italian cities of time, but perhaps not a great deal better. And it might look from a human viewpoint as if his life had been wasted. But in the ultimate, I wouldn't be surprised if the Reformation was 50% more effective than it would have been without what Savonarola had done. It might even not have been strong enough, humanly speaking, in its early days to get really underway if it had not been for this influence that Savonarola exerted, a considerable part of which was through Pico, and then through Colette, and then into Erasmus. Because Erasmus' writings were read all over Europe and had a great influence, even among those who had no sympathy with what he presented. They enjoyed his clever ways of saying things so very much that his influence was very much greater than people realized. Now, this was in 1498 when Savonarola was killed, and 5 years later, Alexander Borgia died. But in between comes the new century. And so we will take Roman numeral 13, which we will call the beginning of the 16th century - the eve of the Reformation. The beginning of the 16th century, the eve of the Reformation. In these centuries here, at this point, it would be good if you could try to keep the general space of time pretty well in hand. I was rather disturbed on one or two of the test papers to find that when I asked to discuss the writers of the 13th century, the writers of the 14th century were discussed under that heading. And it's as if somebody were asked, describe conditions in America in 1963, and they'd say Abraham Lincoln was president. Well, that's a century off, and a century is quite a considerable time, especially when things are moving rapidly as they are today, or as they were at that time. In the period between 500 and 1,000, if you're 150 years off, it won't be particularly important. But when it comes to the period before 450, you ought to know within 25 years of any important event. And when it comes to the period since 1,000, you certainly ought to know within a century of any important event. Particularly when you take these writers, you have the writers of the period of one period with the beginning of Scholasticism, the 1100s, the 12th century, with a few great writers. Then you have the 13th century with that great outpouring of Scholasticism, with the great theological writers of that period, and one or two who represent a somewhat different trend. And then when you come to the 14th century, you have a period of decline as far as theological writing is concerned, but you have those wonderful pious writings, devotional writings of the Brothers of the Common Light, and you have the beginning of national literature. So it would be quite important to keep those three centuries rather distinct in your mind. And then you have your 15th century, which was a time when there was comparatively little written of importance in a devotional or in a theological area, but when you had the great struggle over conciliarism and the coming of the Renaissance and the more paganizing type of interest with the humanists. And if I ask you for one particular century and you give another, why, it's pretty hard to know. If you say, this ought to discuss these five writers under this head, and you find not one of them described, well, you feel as if the question ought to have a zero. But then you find that five others are nicely described that don't belong there, and it puts me in a difficult quandary to know just whether I should give it a zero or give it a halfway mark or what. And so please preserve me from that quandary by getting the keeping the centuries well in mind prior to the examination next week. But now we have the beginning of the 16th century, 1500. Of course, there's one very unfortunate thing, that in our common usage, the 15th century is the 1400s. We're in the 20th century, though, the 1900s, and that is very confusing. But it is regular, established historical usage, historical and literary. And so I think we better become accustomed to it, even though I have to stop and think about it myself. It is not easy, but it is really necessary if you're going to deal with these matters. Well, now this next fall we take up the Reformation. And the Reformation begins in 1517. So we only have a period of 17 years yet to cover in our discussion of Europe before the Reformation. But we want to see what the situation was at that time when the Reformation began and how these events we've been looking at were leading up to the Reformation. The corruption of the church had been realized for at least three centuries. Time and again, people had written ardently seeking reform of the church. There had been great councils, as we noticed, the Council of Constance, the Council of Pisa, and by the way, Pisa is P-I-S-A, not P-I-Z-Z-A. But the Council of Basel, you remember, which the Pope moved to Florence, Ferrara. These councils, which represented the leaders of all of Europe, had worked for reform in the church, but nothing had been accomplished. And here at the beginning of the Reformation, you have the papacy stronger than it had ever been in history. Perhaps not quite as powerful as in the days of Innocent III, when they were able to raise up and put down monarchs in many of the countries of Europe, but certainly far more powerful in its immediate situation in Italy, and perhaps two-thirds as powerful in Europe as a whole, as it was under Innocent III back in the 13th century. And you have the papacy with no interest whatever in reform. You don't have a widespread devotional life at this time, not as much as 150 years before. But you do have individuals in every country in Europe who knew the gospel. They couldn't express it as well as Luther expressed. They couldn't express it as well as some have learned to express it since. But they certainly were people who had the essence of the matter, who were devoted to Christ and to what he had done for them, and anxious to win others to them in every country of Europe. But they were a very small minority. You had a situation here where it looked humanly hopeless that there would be a reform of the church. But God sent a great genius. Luther's one of the great geniuses in all history. He was a man who had an ability to express things in a way that caught the attention and caught the interest and held it. And then you had the invention of printing, which occurred during the 15th century, but there was comparatively little printed as yet. And printing made it possible that Luther's influence should become widespread, and the excellence of Luther's writing increased the interest in printing. And in some years, fully half of the actual books printed were books written by Luther, which shows how much printing helped in the rise of the Reformation, and Luther's popularity helped. That is, the excellence of his writing, which won people to read it all over Europe, helped in raising up the printing industry. So that by the end of Luther's time, there were 20 or 30 times as many books being printed each year as there were when the Reformation began. Printing had been in existence about 50 years when the Reformation began, but comparatively little had been printed up to that time. Savonarola's two Bibles were both printed. They were Latin Bibles. Both of them had been printed. And a few Bibles and a few other books had been printed, but comparatively few by this time. But God brought printing and the genius of Martin Luther just at the same time. And then, though, Luther had a genius of popular presentation and the expression of moving people that went far beyond that of Wycliffe or of Huss. Yet, both of them had been destroyed and their work brought practically to naught. Luther would have too if it had not been that the political situation the Lord caused should work out in such a way that Luther was protected until the work became too great for it to be destroyed. So there were many things that worked together to make the Reformation possible. But most of them we look at next fall. We're interested now in the situation here in these first 17 years. And so we'll make A under this the papacy. The papacy. Alexander Borgia was pope until 1503. He was not in advanced years. He was in late middle age, very strong. His son, Caesar, was very, very active. And they seemed to have everything their own way as they were getting more and more control in Italy. And then in 1503, Alexander and Caesar were both taken ill at the same time. The story that was spread all through Italy was that they had invited some people they wanted to get rid of to have dinner with them, and that they had served poisoned food, but that the servants had made a mistake and that the Pope and his son got the poisoned food. Now, there is no proof that that is true at all, but the attitude all through Italy, in fact, all through Europe, towards the Borgias, was that it was very, very dangerous to even eat with them. That they had committed many poisons. I don't know whether we have any way of proving that now. There's no doubt they were implicated in many murders and in much of with daggers and that sort of thing. They were mixed up in all sorts of wickedness, licentiousness, and sin. And the Cardinal della Rovere, who was a nephew of Sixtus IV, just as Alexander Borgia had been a nephew of Calixtus III, you remember, Rovere had been going around Europe quite a bit during the time that Alexander was pope, trying to get the monarchs of Europe to call a general council to do away with Alexander, because he said he had won the papacy through Simon, that he had paid tremendous bribes to the cardinals to vote for him. Well, Alexander and Caesar were both ill, and then Alexander died, and Caesar was still ill. Caesar had figured he'd be able to control things if his father died, but he was ill, unable to do anything except just to send a servant to go to where his father had died and to seize the papal chamberlain and tell him he must give him access to the treasury or he would kill him. And so the man gave him access to the treasury, and he took 100,000 ducats and brought it to Caesar. Later, Caesar was forced to return. But Caesar was thus unable to do anything, and another pope was elected who only lived a month. But still, Caesar was not in a position then of power, and Cardinal della Rovere became the next pope. So that's number one, Julius II. And Julius II was about as different from Alexander Borgia as a man can very well be, and Pharaoh, who speaks constantly about how about Borgia's viciousness and how the Vatican was like a brothel and how many illegitimate children he had and all that sort of thing. He has nothing but praise for Julius II. He was a man after Pharaoh's own heart. But he was different from any other pope perhaps in history. Julius II was anxious to get the papal states, to get much of Italy under direct absolute control of the pope. He had a couple of illegitimate sons, but he kept them more or less out of sight. He didn't flaunt them in public like Alexander Borgia had done. But he did not have a son who was a skillful general like Caesar Borgia was to take over these things. So he himself personally led his army. And he rode on horseback in full armor at the head of his army, and he conquered city after city. Michelangelo was at this time in Rome, and Julius set Michelangelo to building great things for him. He decided to build a great monument to himself to be in St. Peter's Church, a monument to Pope Julius, to have a big statue of Julius, and then to have statues of Moses and other biblical worthies round about. And it was a tremendous plan that Julius made. He set Michelangelo at it. Michelangelo got that wonderful statue of Moses, which is in Rome now, finished for the monument. And then the Pope called him to Bologna, where he had just conquered the city, and he ordered Michelangelo to make a large metal statue of himself there. And Michelangelo spent a long time making the plan for this colossal-sized statue of Julius II, and then making a cast so that he could cast it out of metal, and it probably would be one of the greatest artistic works ever made, this wonderful statue of Julius II, which Michelangelo made. But then the people of Bologna were able to drive the papal army out, and in order to protect themselves, they took the statue and they smelted it up and used it for bullets. And so this great work of art was lost to the world. But Julius II went on through the years that he was pope, carrying on his fighting, his military activities. Made a beautiful picture of him. Michelangelo painted for the Vatican, and Michelangelo said, "Well, now," he said, "shall I have you holding a book in your hand?" "No," he says, "I'm no scholar. Put a sword in my hand." And so he's pictured with a sword in his hand. And Julius was a very strange sort of a figure to be the head of an ecclesiastical organization, even though Pharaoh speaks so very, very highly of him. And when Julius died, there appeared a satire which was distributed all through Europe. And this satire is generally believed to be by Erasmus, but Erasmus never admitted that he himself had written. And so there's some who deny that Erasmus wrote it. But it's so brilliantly done that there's no one else of whom we know at that time who had quite the genius to write this clever satire that Erasmus had. So many feel pure Erasmus wrote it. But it is called Julius Excluded from Heaven. And it describes Pope Julius dying and coming up to the gates of heaven, and St. Peter asking who he was and what right he has to come there, and Julius telling how he fought, and Peter saying, "Well, now, if you were a successor of mine, you'd be interested in giving the word of God to the sheep rather than in fighting and conquering cities." And they go on with quite a discussion, and finally, Peter says, "You can't come in here." And Julius says, "I'll give you 3 months to open the gates, and if you don't, I'll come with 200,000 men and batter them open." And this was distributed all over Europe, this satire called Julius Excluded. I don't think Pharaoh mentions this particular thing in the book. But then, that's number one, Julius II, and number two is Leo X. And Leo X was the son of Lorenzo de' Medici, whom we saw in Florence, the man at whose deathbed Savonarola was present. Leo X was, through the influence of his father, a pope prior to Alexander Borgia, had made the young boy a cardinal when he was 14 years of age. And he had been given many high positions in the church, none of which he had to do anything for, but from which he drew the high income, because of the desire of these popes to conciliate the Medici. And so in 1513, when Julius II became died, this young man, who was then 38 years of age, who had been a cardinal since he was 14, a very pleasant young fellow, a very nice change from Alexander Borgia with his great wickedness, or Julius II with his great constant belligerency, was elected to be the next pope. And Giovanni de' Medici took the name of Leo X. And he was the pope at the time when the Reformation began. He was pope from 1513 to 1521. Leo X lacked one of Julius II's virtues. He was not a good manager. Julius II had watched the finances very carefully. He sold church offices and indulgences and used every method to bring in money, but he watched the money carefully and he built up the treasury and he had things in good shape, while Leo X spent lavishly. Somebody said he spent all the income of the that was saved by the previous papacy, all that his own time gathered, and all that the next one would have to gather to pay the debt that he built. But he had lavish great banquets, had great plays put on in the Vatican. He got the greatest artists of the time to make wonderful works of art. Those of you who've seen the picture of Martin Luther, it shows Leo X. In the Vatican, and he hears the money from the indulgences is falling off in Germany, and he says, how are we going to pay Michelangelo? How are we going to pay Raphael with this money dropping from? Well, he had these great artists busy painting for him. He made Michelangelo rather upset, because Michelangelo had set to work to make this marvelous monument for Julius II to be the main thing in St. Peter's Church, which had then been well started, and Julius was gone, so they just dropped that idea. And the statue of Moses is in a little church off in another part of Rome today, and Michelangelo had promised to do the rest for Julius, and all his life he wanted to go on, but the popes kept giving him new things to do. And he was sent to Florence in order to make a great monument for the Medici. And there in Florence, the so-called Medici tombs is one of the greatest artworks in the world, which was done because of the Medici now becoming pope. But Leo X was not given to the sort of voluptuousness and wickedness in the Alexander Borgia had been. There were no stories of any murders or poisons or anything like that circulated in his time. There was he liked theatricals. He liked all sorts of light frivolity, but the type of degenerate wickedness of Alexander Borgia was not found anymore there. Was not like Julius. He didn't lead the army. Somebody said that Venus was the sovereign in Rome in one pontificate, and then Mars, but now both of them were gone. He was a fine gentleman, a hunter, an accomplished host, one who patronized art and literature. One of the great writers of the day said that he would have been a perfect pope if he'd had any interest in religion. But he had no interest either in theology and religious theorizing, nor did he have any interest in devotional life or practical religion, though he carried out the ceremonies very faithfully. He fasted on regular occasions, and had his regular masses and performed all the ceremonies, but there was no evidence he had any particular interest in them. And so this was the situation in the papacy when
the Reformation broke out. Now, of course, Luther didn't know this. Luther wrote one work addressed to Leo in which he said, "You are a sheep in the midst of wolves. You are a dino in the midst of lions." And in this, he addressed him as the simple people of Europe thought or taught to think that the Pope was. Luther eventually found out quite differently, and before the end of his life, his last great writing, there's a Jesuit who has written a great life of Luther in five big volumes. And in one of them, he speaks of Luther's tremendous energy. And he says the last great work that Luther wrote, he says, is the amount of research and the amount of careful study and writing that goes into it, he says it's difficult to imagine how much there was in this, just this one great work, which is one of the last works that Luther wrote. But in the translation of this work into English, they put the name of Luther's last great work in German rather than translating it into English, because the meaning of it is the papacy, the foundation of the devil. And so in this Roman Catholic work, they didn't like to give the title even in English, even while he's praising the tremendous energy and activity that went into writing the book and saying how he wished he'd been on their side instead of on the other side. But this was the change in Luther's attitude which took place as he came to see more and more what the situation was in Rome. As Luther's interest was in reaching people with the gospel, and he thought at first, of course, the Pope will favor this. The Pope must have been misinformed about this. He expected, he appealed from the Pope ill-informed to the Pope better-informed. But at Rome, the leadership was in the hands of men like Alexander VI and Julius II and Leo X. Now I think we should take a heading for Erasmus. Capital B, Erasmus. Because Erasmus was a figure that had tremendous influence at this time. Very tremendous influence. And as I said, it is it probably would have been fairly easy to root out the Reformation before it got started if it were not for certain situations which delayed the strong effort in that direction. And one of these situations was the effect of Erasmus's influence. Because this was a day when the humanistic influences were already rather widely spread, and there were all over Europe people who tremendously admired the beautiful writing. And there was there's never anyone, at least since ancient Roman days, who wrote Latin better than Erasmus did. They loved to read his Latin writing simply for the wonderful style of it. And it's interesting that in recent years there have been reprinted a number of times just within the last few years Erasmus's work called In Praise of Folly. And in this work, Erasmus represents Moriah, the Latin word for folly. He represents folly as a great one who is honored and then praises folly. Of course, it's all satirical, but he praises, shows folly's great effectiveness in having popes who do such foolish things, and archbishops and priests and so on, and he satirically deals with the whole ecclesiastical situation of the day. He wrote this shortly after he had become acquainted with Colette. How much Colette's influence had to do with Erasmus's doing this is hard to say. But Erasmus wrote many works which, with this light, clever approach, escaped attack. A century later, in the index, as it was called, which listed what Roman Catholics were forbidden to read, they took dozens of pages to list writings of Erasmus, or pages in Erasmus, which the faithful were forbidden to even look at. But in his time, while there were those who strongly opposed him and who saw the import of what he was writing, the popes of his day all favored him. And even toward the end of Erasmus' life, he was offered to be made a cardinal. And he was honored by many of the popes, even though some of the monks and of the inquisitors tried at various times to make trouble for him. But his great style, his clever writing. When I was in college, I remember the a woman who taught a course in modern history that I took, who said, "Oh, if only there had been, instead of a revolution like Luther brought, if we'd only had the evolution that Erasmus was trying to bring, how much better it would have been." Well, of course, that is utter nonsense. Erasmus never would have produced any great change. Erasmus helped prepare the way for a great change. He helped make it possible for the Reformation to go forward. He made an atmosphere which was helpful to us. But Erasmus had no direct influence toward change at any time. And Erasmus also was always looking out for his own interest. He was always looking out for his own interest, although he did, Colette did influence him to make him really take a tremendous interest in the Greek text of the Bible and in the early Christian fathers and so on, and he did great services in those regards. He was always looking out for his reward and for his fame. And any time that there would come a question or an attack that seemed dangerous to Erasmus, he would immediately excuse himself or say that wasn't what he meant at all, and he never allowed himself to be put in a position where he was in any personal danger. While Luther stood for the truth no matter what came, and Luther expected he wouldn't live long, and if it weren't for the wonderful providence of God, he certainly wouldn't have. But God worked in a marvelous way to make it possible that the Reformation should get underway. Now we look more at the conditions of that time tomorrow.